Good morning. This is Jerry Parishman, high above CW Post here out in Long Island, bringing you another weekly session of Project Independence programs for knowledge, information, and good times here in Long Island for seniors. Remember, if you have an issue, have a problem, call us at 311, and you'll be tied into the service network that makes your life more meaningful, more interesting, and more rewarding. Today I have David Linden, working with me as our co-host.
Good morning.
And David has been an old friend, and I'm sure we're going to have a wonderful 2 hours with you folks out there. And today we have a special guest, James Call, who's adjunct professor of American and Constitutional History at Hofstra and Nassau Community College, and the founder of Change NYS Org, a not-for-profit organization formed to promote the education of New Yorkers about the need for civic education and political reform in our state. James lives in Seaford, New York, and I just found out he's a member of the New York City Police Force, detective there. James, I'm so pleased you could take the time us today.
Thank you for having me, Jer.
Yes,
David.
Yes. It is good to see you. Are you a Hofstra graduate by any chance?
Yes, I got my undergraduate degree at Hofstra.
Right. Of course, I see you teach here also.
Right.
You teach American and Constitutional History.
Yes, sir.
And somebody asked whether you're a lawyer, and you said you're not a lawyer.
I'm not a lawyer. My dad tried to talk me into going to law school. He said, I will buy you a car if you go to law school. Okay. And then I guess his thinking was eventually I will then buy him a car after I became
and
a lawyer.
And then another car.
Right. But I really liked the idea of studying history. I liked reading about how others had taken the Constitution and changed it. I didn't necessarily want to do that myself.
I'm going to ask you a fundamental question.
Yes, sir.
You think the Articles of Confederation were superior to the Constitution or inferior to the Constitution?
Well, I think that there were some benefits under the Articles of Confederation. I mean, we waged war successfully against one of the greatest superpowers in the world in the 1770s into the 1780s under the Articles of Confederation for the most part. But there were many flaws to the document during peacetime. So it was a good wartime document, but it was a bad peacetime document. And we saw the flaws in that document. And that governing framework once we were victorious over England.
So in effect, you're saying that the Constitution we have is a step forward for all of us.
Absolutely. The Constitution is a remarkable document.
Now, let me ask you another question. In many countries, the Constitution is almost completely revised every 25 years, every 50 years. What's your thoughts about that we are having constitutional conventions every X number of years and going through the thing from A to Z and bringing it up to date, you might say solidifying the virtues that are in the Constitution?
Sure. I mean, there's kind of a continuing thread through our through our governing documents, or the Charters of Freedom, as we call them, the Declaration of Independence, into the Constitution, into the Bill of Rights. But any part of the Constitution that we don't like, we don't have to wait for a convention. We don't have to wait every 20 years. We have the Article 5 provisions, which allow us to change the document through an amendment process. We could do that almost any day we wanted to. It's a very difficult process. I don't mean to make it sound like it's an easy thing. It's not something that we do often. We've only done it 27 times in over 230 years. And with the Bill of Rights, we did it 10 times in one fell swoop. Mm-hmm. So from 1791, when the Bill of Rights was adopted, to today, we have changed the document 17 times. It's not something that we do often, but we have provisions in the document in order to change it.
There are people on the Supreme Court. I'm thinking of the late Justice Scalia, for instance, who referred to himself as an originalist, trying to maintain the decisions of the court on what the founders said then. I personally think that's a little foolish, because then was over 200 years ago, and there were different circumstances. The Second Amendment being, sure, you could keep your musket, but not your AK-47.
Sure.
How do you feel about the originalist concept?
So I think Antonin Scalia himself, when he was alive, he articulated that, you know, this idea of original meaning, like what did they mean for these words to be interpreted as? Even Scalia himself, Justice Scalia, had kind of dismissed that idea. He said, there's no way that I, as a judge or a justice, could know what was in your thoughts as a legislator as you were passing a bill. What Antonin Scalia did adhere to, and a number of the justices still adhere to, is the idea of being textualists. Instead of trying to figure out what they meant the words to mean, let's actually read the words. And in looking at the document, there are really three ways to interpret it. One is the originalist meaning. What did they intend the 14th Amendment to mean? What did they intend, as you mentioned, the Second Amendment to mean? And then the other way is textualist. We read the words of the document. The other way is this kind of living constitution where the words mean whatever that kind of generation or time period would allow the words to mean. So there are multiple approaches to interpreting the Constitution. Scalia, I don't think he himself would put himself in the box of an originalist. You'd have to become almost like an amateur sleuth or historian trying to figure out and read people's minds. And there's any number of reasons why a legislator would pass a law. Are they passing it because they agree with the concept in the law? Or because if I pass this law, another legislator will pass a law that I want? We can't possibly know what hundreds of legislators mean and intend, not just at the federal level, but at the state level as they're reading and interpreting clauses of the Constitution. So what he says often in many of his opinions is that, well, what do the words of the document say?
So justice really should be flexible.
Well, flexible to a degree. But not so flexible that the words have no meaning.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, Jim, I'm impressed with your background and your answers. But tell us about the organization. That's important, too.
So my organization that I started a few years back is changenys.org. That's the organization you're speaking of, right? So I started this because I noticed that we're not having many conversations about government in New York State. We have lots of conversations about government in Washington, D.C. And I think that because we speak so much about government in D.C., it tends to give Albany a pass. And there's lots of issues that we have with government up in Albany that are not partisan, that have nothing to do with Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, but kind of look at the structure of government. I mean, ballot access, how difficult it is in this state to be a candidate running for office. The requirements are pretty strict. I found that out myself last year when I ran for Nassau County Legislature in my district when there was an open seat there. Also, voting requirements. We're one of the few states that still require you to vote between 6 a.m. and 9 p.m. on election day. Many other states have early voting. They allow you to, you know, vote prior to election day. Our state, the requirements are very, very strict. Other structural changes that I thought should be addressed.
You're focusing on greater citizen participation.
Absolutely.
In the electoral process.
Yes, sir.
Right.
That's one facet. Right. The other things are more structural. How you know, clauses in our government that are, you know, 100-plus years old, our Constitution says that you cannot discriminate based upon race, based upon your nation of origin, and based on religion. There's lots of things that are left out.
Like sexual orientation.
Sexual orientation, yes. Age, gender, run down the laundry list of things that we in our state and many other states think should be constitutionally protected, and they're not by our Constitution.
Yeah, this is something that seniors might be interested in, that's absentee voting. Is New York State progressive in terms of supporting absentee voting?
Well,
is it an easy process?
It's we could say it's an easy process because you kind of can notify the Board of Elections and they will give you an absentee ballot. The problem in New York State is that in order for you to file an absentee ballot, you're basically signing an affidavit saying you will not be in the district on the day of election, on election day. So for people that are kind of housebound or people that can't get to the polls, if you're still in the district and you file an absentee ballot, you're basically violating the law.
A housebound senior, let's say someone who's recovering from an illness or a,
right.
would say, well, I don't think I want to go out November 7th. Send me a ballot. Dutifully fills it out, puts it in the mailbox, gets it out. He or she's violated the law.
Well, I don't know if the SWAT team is going to be coming through that door, but the affidavit is.
Right, but in effect, in a very narrow legal sense, you've done it. In effect, what you're saying is that changes should be taking place to make it easier, that no one should feel that they're violating the law because they voted absentee, even though they came back to their legal voting residence on election day.
Other states have explored ways of making it easier to vote. I mean, while we make it easier to vote, we need to make sure that we protect the franchise and make sure that there's not people exploiting that. I know that that's one of the fears about online voting, is that people would kind of get in and tap into that hack, for lack of a better expression.
No, I understand, for example, in Oregon, the elections are all mailed. Right. Was that something that your group might promote?
Well, I'm open to having a conversation about anything that allows voting to be easier in our state while we are, protecting the, sanctity of that process. So I think we're still in our state, and my organization is still in the exploratory phase of looking at what other states are doing and trying to figure out what is successful in those states and what works and what doesn't. I think we should be open to that conversation as we're having now.
Jim, I'm going to make a statement based on just one thing, and you're going to tell me whether I'm correct or not, that in New York State, let's say there, far fewer people are conversant and understand and know anything about the New York State Constitution than they do about the federal Constitution.
Absolutely. I think that is, there's kind of this attraction to the national, government because of the powers that they have and the impact that they have on our lives. But we should be having more conversations about the impact of local and state government because we could say on a day-to-day basis that impacts our lives much greater than the national government might. There definitely is this kind of lack of knowledge or lack of conversation related to our state government that we should be having, not just in our schools, but in our communities and, at the water cooler workplaces.
I confess, if somebody said, can you give me a copy of the state constitution, I wouldn't know where to start looking.
Well, you can go to my website. My homepage, and there's a copy of the state constitution, and I've written numerous op-eds about ways that we could change it, ways that we could make not just the people more connected with the state government, but our state more connected with the nation. And there are ways that we could do that through state laws to make us more part of the
conversation. Jim, give us a couple of examples of what you're promoting.
Well, one example would be how we allocate electoral votes in our state for the presidency. Mm-hmm. We have like 47 other states, a winner-take-all system. So whoever wins by even one vote, the popular vote in our state, they get all 29 electoral votes. Mm. Now, what that has done is that has allowed Democrats to take our votes for granted at the national level and Republicans to write us off. It's not accidental that the recent tax bill disproportionately affects states like New York and California because Republicans don't really need at the national level to pay much attention to those states because they lose them in every election since 1988. So one of the things that we could do is allocate electoral votes based on congressional districts. Now, Nebraska and Maine do that. And what that would do is that would force competition into those districts where the vote is within 5 percentage points of each of the candidates.
We're going to have to break for a couple of announcements, a couple of minutes. Let you catch your breath, and we'll be back with you on the hot seat. But it's a great hot seat, isn't it?
It's room temperature.
Right. Very great.